From the Land-Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Mark Report. It's the 27th day of November, 2008. I'm Todd Gleason. Happy Thanksgiving. The markets are closed today, but will be open again for the Friday session. We have a special program of interviews for you from our recent trip to the National Association of Farm Broadcasting Convention in Kansas City. It includes an interview about the commodity markets with David Ward. He's a senior risk manager at CIH in Chicago, Illinois. A discussion of how Farm Credit Services tries to finance, aid, and encourage new and beginning farmers. And where we normally would discuss the ag weather, we'll instead talk cash rents with Murray Weiss from the Westchester Group. It all happens on this Thanksgiving Day edition of the Closing Market Report. The Closing Mark Report is a production of WILL. It's public radio from the University of Illinois. From the Chicago Board of Trade on a Wednesday afternoon, futures finished the day like this in the day trade. Nearby contract for the soft red, a 535 and a half settlement price, up a penny and a half today. March at 554, up one and a quarter. July settled at 581 and a quarter for soft red winter wheat, up a penny on the afternoon. In September at 603 and a half, up a quarter. December corn futures, 354, a half higher. The March at 371, up a half. May at 382 and a quarter, up a half. And July futures from the corn pit at 393 and three quarters, up three quarters of a cent. Next year's December, 418 and a quarter, up three quarters for the day. January soybeans at $8.86, a settlement price on a Wednesday afternoon, up 3 cents. This is yesterday's trade. Closed in Chicago, of course, today. March futures, 894, up 2.5. The May at 903 and three quarters, up 3.25. And July at 913, 3 cents higher. November, 907, up a nickel on the afternoon. December bean meal futures at 263.20, up 70. The January unchanged at 262. December bean oil at 32.50, up 26. January bean oil on a Wednesday afternoon for the settlement prices from yesterday, 22 higher at 32.86. Taking a look at the livestock numbers, nearby December lean or live cattle at 87.42 and a half, $1.60 higher. February at 88.15, up 82 and a half. And the January feeder cattle at 92.20, settled 80 cents higher. March futures at 92.92 and a half, up 67 and a half cents. December lean hog futures, 58.67 and a half, 95 cents higher. The lean futures for the hogs February contract at 65.77 and a half, up $1.17 and a half. Be sure to visit our website. The address is willag.org. That's willag.org. For University of Illinois Extension, I'm Todd Gleason. Happy Thanksgiving. Here's a list of turkey facts you might find of interest. Did you know that Ben Franklin, in a letter to his daughter, proposed the turkey as the official United States bird? In 2007, the average American ate 17.75 pounds of turkey. The heaviest turkey ever raised was 86 pounds. That's about the size of a large dog. A 15-pound turkey usually has about 70% white meat and 30% dark meat. The male turkey is called a tom. The female turkey is a hen. The turkey was domesticated in Mexico and brought to Europe in the 16th century. Wild turkeys can fly for short distances up to 55 miles per hour. Wild turkeys can run 20 miles an hour. Turkeys' heads change color when they get excited. And most of the turkey raised for commercial production are called White Hollands. It takes 75 to 80 pounds of feed to raise a 30-pound tom turkey. A domesticated male turkey can reach a weight of 30 pounds within 18 weeks after hatching. 45 million turkeys are eaten each Thanksgiving, 22 million turkeys at Christmas, and 19 million turkeys are eaten at Easter. Male turkeys gobble, hens do not. They make a clicking noise. Turkeys have heart attacks. The United States Air Force was doing test runs and breaking the sound barrier. Nearby turkeys dropped dead of heart attacks. And finally, the five most popular ways to serve leftover turkey are as a sandwich, stew, chili or soup, casserole, or a burger. Hey, have a great Thanksgiving. If you'd like to see more odd turkey facts, visit the University of Illinois Urban Extension's website. That's urbanext.uiuc.edu.
Todd Gleason's services are made available by University of Illinois Extension.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report. It's a Thursday afternoon, November the 27th. I'm Todd Gleason. Coming up, an interview I did at the National Association of Farm Broadcasting Convention with David Ward. He's with CIH, that's the Commodity and Ingredient Hedging Company, out of Chicago, Illinois.
Commodity Ingredient Hedging focuses on agricultural price risk management. So essentially, our client base would include domestic farmers growing corn, soybeans, or wheat, domestic co-ops or elevators, import-export terminals, and end users, such as food companies, livestock producers, as well as overseas buyers of U.S. commodities.
Which one do you specialize in?
I would say the majority of our time is probably spent on the end user side, primarily hog production, livestock production throughout the U.S.
Good, because I talk about the production side all the time, but I rarely run into anybody who specializes in the end user side. Been a tough year for them, I would think.
You know, it most certainly have. I mean, we try and focus on a margin-based relationship. So instead of just looking at, oh, feed costs are high, or oh, revenues are low, we're looking at the combination of cost versus revenues in a margin standpoint. The good news is, if you've been managing price risk and looking, say, a year down the road, nearby margins have been pretty poor as you're trying to adjust for higher feed costs and lower revenues. But in the case of hog production, for example, if you look 6 months down the road, and yes, you have $4 corn, and but if you look at hog values at, say, $80, there's actually a decent margin to work with. You know, so we're trying to focus on managing price risk, not just for the near-term concern, but also 12 to 18 months down the road.
Well, hog values certainly aren't at $80. You think it's going back there?
I think you know, the biggest issue that we're dealing with is, thank goodness, we're starting to consolidate the hog industry and reduce some supplies moving forward, as of the last USDA reports. You know, the biggest concerns are, over the last few years, since we have gone to exporting between 20 and 25% of our production, the whole financial sector slowing down and the economy globally becoming a concern. The loss of our exports in 2009, a reduction of, is probably the biggest concern on price going forward. As, you know, as far as pork exports go, we were running a pace of like 100% increase in exports year over year, so essentially doubling our export numbers. The last numbers we have for exports, which are always 6 weeks behind, we're showing like a 55% increase year over year. You know, so to clarify, we are showing still continued year over year growth in the pork export. However, instead of doubling from year to year, it's only a 50% increase year to year.
And in that same process, then we have also liquidated some of the herd.
Yeah, so you know, right now we were running, you know, first quarter last year maybe anywhere between 8% and 12% increase in pork produced year over year. That number has come down to, you know, between 0% and 3% year over year increase in pork. Yeah, by the time we get to probably February or April 2009, it might be that teeter-totter point where we go to below year-over-year pork production, as indicated by the breeding stocks going forward.
So liquidation has taken place, exports are falling off, but the two of them together should combine to be okay for hog prices in the coming year.
Yeah, in an ideal scenario, if you can mix together an appropriate reduction of supplies into 2009 to help offset the reduction of exports, that would be the ideal scenario. Our bigger concerns are, you know, again, since there's some pretty decent margins 6 months down the road, that we might not see as much liquidation as was indicated from the USDA reports. We've seen that for the last couple of years where liquidation was expected. But once we got into that marketing period, inventories are a bit higher than expected.
And is this part and parcel because of and I'll go back to the word consolidation of the industry, that there are mostly pork producers that just produce pork, and so that trying to liquidate herds on the margin has disappeared as those small farmers that just come in and out of the marketplace with the hogs has gone away with the consolidation. So the question then is, do you believe the USDA numbers, or does hog production just stay steady in the U.S. because it's consistent all the time?
And that was a reference to consolidation. We've seen a lot of consolidation over the years. We continue to see some more consolidation as more of these smaller farms get bought out by larger operations. Our client base produces about 24% U.S. pork production. You know, I think one of the things that we're seeing over the years is that the perception that is a hog producer doesn't manage price risk. They're subject to the whims of the nearby cash markets. What we see is a lot of our producers managing forward price risk. You know, for example, out of that 24-25% is production, I'll bet you our client base is probably 50% hedged for 2009. Yeah, so the perception being is that nearby margins are extremely poor, that there has to be liquidation 6 or 9 or 12 months down the road. When we get to that period in time, we're seeing that a lot of our clients and a lot of other producers out there do have a lot of that price risk already managed, so they're not subject to the poor margins that you see from high corn prices and lower hog revenues near term. You know, a good portion of that's already been hedged, and those producers are not reducing supplies very much because they have protected it.
Yeah, so they're hedged on both sides of the market, the input side and their own personal production.
Yeah, we very much advocate the idea of margin management. I mean, historically, people have tried to manage corn prices when they're low in the fall and try and sell their hog values high when they're in their summer, and that's gotten people in a lot of trouble trying to protect just one side of the equation. We advocate that the only proper risk management program would be to manage a margin standpoint, protect input costs at the same time as revenues when that margin is attractive. So we've seen a lot of folks protecting both sides of the equation, both costs and revenues at the same time.
All right, so let's turn around to the corn and soybean producer. Given what you know about the usage side of the marketplace, at least the domestic usage for livestock, and if you're running about 24% of production, then you know a lot. How is it that you view demand for corn in the coming year? Will it slack off? Are the USDA numbers correct there?
Yeah, well, you have three main factors in demand for corn. Obviously, you have livestock, you know, feed usage, you know, which up till now has been pretty good growth year over year. But as we just discussed, these livestock numbers are coming down. Poultry is already down year over year. Hogs will probably be down year over year sometime in Jan to Feb. And beef's definitely heading that direction, looking at cattle on feed. You know, so 2009, you would expect to see a smaller feed usage for corn and soybeans. Obviously, you expect to see an increase on ethanol production. You know, as of the last numbers, you had 3 billion bushels of corn going to ethanol in 2008. It's forecasted for about 4 billion bushels of corn going to ethanol in 2009. You know, pretty dramatic increase, talking about a third of the corn crop going to ethanol production. That'll be partially offset by the availability of DDGs, for example, going to poultry and hogs specifically. So that'll offset some of that corn going into livestock, since it can be replaced by DDGs coming out of the ethanol plants. That would be the second component, you know, ethanol consumption of corn. Obviously, the third would be the exports, which is another big chunk of where our demand comes from. We've experienced some really good demand from the export market when the dollar is low for the last year or so. You know, the dollar's had a bit of a rally here these last few months, as we all know, and that hurts the meat export as well as the grain export. So that was the big change in the USDA report last week, is taking a pretty good chunk out of the export market, partially due to the increase in the dollar, and of course partially due to the troubles in the economy, slowing down demand globally.
Okay, so then if you take a look at this, do you have a range in which you think producers should be looking to hedge out of corn in a soybean crop for 09?
That's a great question. As far as grain production goes, this time of the year you had a historical low in price as you're harvesting the grain and supply becomes available on the market. We're typically in the camp of re-owning some of that old crop corn right now, mostly through a call option, for example. But it's a good time of year to potentially re-own some of those sales you made, hopefully back in June, July, at $7 or $8 plus on the corn side. Historically speaking, we're not looking at hedging production that you're growing until probably March. You know, historically, that's a high time of the year as you're getting the planters rolling and build a little bit of premium into it, trying to figure out what's going to get planted. The concern, obviously, is for high input costs that we saw from last year, wondering what that corn planted acreage is versus soybeans or versus wheat. But right now, desire is to probably re-own a little bit of corn in a call option. Same thing for soybeans or wheat. Probably not look at hedging production until probably March. But one thing is interesting to note that if you do have corn in inventory right now, looking at the spreads from, say, DS08 out to July 09, you know, it spreads at pretty wide carry right now. So if you do look at it, put on some hedges against current inventory, probably makes a lot of sense to keep that short position out in a deferred month, say July 09.
Okay, David, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Sounds great. Thank you for your time.
David Ward is with Commodity and Ingredients Hedging in Chicago, Illinois.
That interview, like the one we're just about to hear with Farm Credit Services, was recorded at the National Association of Farm Broadcasting Convention in Kansas City 2 weeks ago today. So we'll move now from commodity markets to paying for developing those crops. I caught up with Vice President of Farm Credit Services, Gary Madison, and discussed the new and beginning farmers programs that Farm Credit Services provides across the nation.
Well, what I was hired to do was to try to coordinate some of the programs that are in the Farm Credit system. Of the 90 or so institutions around Farm Credit in this country, they each have their own. They each tailor their young beginning small farmer programs to the local market. And up until now, there hasn't been any national perspective on trying to aggregate the best ideas that are out there in the countryside to be able to spread those from one institution to another. So that's one of the main focuses of what I'm doing.
And how long have you been at this?
I've been at this since January of this year. So my previous background was as a cut flower producer in New Hampshire. So I won't tell you how long ago, but at one time I was a young beginning small farmer myself.
Was there a predecessor to you in this process, or are you the first one?
Now, this is a newly created position. The system leadership took a look at how Farm Credit was telling its story, and we know that our capability to raise a new generation of young beginning small farmers is important to our future as much as it is to all of agriculture. And the system leaders took a look at that situation and said, you know, we need to make a little bit more effort to tell our story about what all those 90 different institutions do and try to develop some programs that can be instituted from a national level. Would be available to each of those institutions should they choose to avail themselves of it. And I think the main focus of what I've found through doing a survey of those institutions is where we need to spend our attention is on business plan development and financial skills training for young beginning small farmers. Somebody who's just going into business needs to have a clear idea in their own mind of what they want to do, but more importantly, if they're going to try to borrow money, they need to be able to talk somebody else into that. They need to be able to go to their lender and convince them that they are creditworthy, that they've got a real plan, and that in the end they're going to pay the money back.
So I assume the way you came to some of this conclusion was that you did your survey, you got things back, so you probably found a couple of these programs maybe around the country. Who's already using those kinds of programs, and are you going to model something on them?
Well, every institution has some kind of program. I would say, just to pick out a couple of the most common programs that more institutions provide than not, would be Young Farmer Institutes, where they would bring in high-powered speakers and do a whole weekend session with invited young beginning farmers that would revolve around business plan development. Another very different scale, but another very popular program is a youth livestock lending program. So a 4-H'er or an FFA person in many parts of the country can go to their local Farm Credit and get a couple of $1,000 loan. Now, you know, we're talking about a kid here, so the goal isn't to, you know, we can't make a contract with them. It's obviously more of kind of a donation, but they're expected to pay it back, and most of the institutions make those kids go through a loan application process. So they're actually learning, as part of their 4-H or FFA project, what borrowing money is like, what they have to do, what's their plan. And that as a theme of what farm credit institutions do for young beginning farmers, I think it's probably the clearest thing that I've seen is getting people ready for a life of good business decisions.
So you get them ready. You train them early if you can through the FFA and 4-H programs. It's kind of interesting. I like that idea. And then you want them to have a good business plan. You're trying to provide them some forum in which they can learn about that. But still, they're talking about if they're beginning farmers as opposed to young farmers. If they're beginning farmers, the expenses to get into a farm operation are enormous. How do you deal with young farmers with their very large expenses to get started?
So, you know, it's a lot easier to see a way for a small operation to start than it is a very large operation. If we're talking a row crop farm in Illinois, and you know, it's you're looking at 1,000 acres and big equipment and all that, you obviously, as a young beginning farmer, you can't just step in and you know, say I'm going to borrow that much money. So what we try to do is make available lending for people to enter into the farming operation slowly. So if it means just borrowing money for a piece of equipment to use on rented ground, to, you know, for an operating loan to start that kind of operation, that's where a lot of lending starts for conventional agriculture. But Farm Credit's also recognized that there are a lot of opportunities for young, beginning, and small farmers in less traditional forms of agriculture. For instance, local food systems production, where anything from a farmer's market to growing up to be a more wholesale vegetable operation, there's an easier transition from a very small scale. You might start with a rototiller and a pickup truck and then grow your way up in that business. So as farm credit institutions around the country have looked at the future of farming, what they've tried to do is support opportunity rather than support solutions. We're not trying to train people to do or encourage people to do exactly what their dad did. We want to give them the opportunity if that's what they want to do, but we're also willing to support new and different operations as long as they've got a business plan and they can show that they're going to have the income to sustain themselves and their farm operation.
And do you believe that on the business plan front you'll be partnering with institutions? Would you partner, for instance, with land grant institution to help put business plans together? What kind of partners, if any, would you be using?
Those kind of partnerships are again established at the local level. There will be the Farm Credit System will be offering an online young beginning farmer training program in the near future. All of those details haven't been worked out yet, but something to be made available to each Farm Credit institution. Many, many farm credit institutions already have such training programs, and many do it in cooperation with Cooperative Extension, or even provide scholarship money so that you can buy that kind of training and consulting from somebody else. So that there are all sorts of solutions that really do depend on what's available in the local market area.
That's Jim Madison with Farm Credit Services. You're listening to the Closing Market Report. In 2 minutes, we'll talk with Murray Wise from the Westchester Group about cash rents. You're listening to the Closing Mark Report from the University of Illinois. I'm Todd Gleason. Up next, an interview with the CEO of the Westchester Group, Murray Wise. We started by asking just how many acres that organization manages.
We manage between 110 and 120,000 acres here in the United States. We manage slightly in excess of 70,000 acres in Australia, and we also have a joint venture relationship in Brazil, which we're just kind of launching at the moment.
Right now you're setting cash rent prices for 09. Tell me about it.
Well, it's a mixed set of circumstances because obviously, as you and I were joking a few moments ago, you know, commodity prices were significantly higher. Commodity prices are now significantly lower. Input costs are dramatically higher, quite frankly. And with that, it's a mixed bag. But in Illinois, we're seeing higher cash rents, which I know most of your listeners won't like to hear, but we're seeing, you know, cash rents in Illinois anywhere from $275 to $475 an acre, with $350 being a pretty common number in this day and age.
I would think they would have been much more cautious about signing cash rents because those numbers have got to be something between $50, $60, $100 more than cash rents in the previous year, right?
Probably even more than $50, $60 more than the previous year. Well, the same token, I think, to reflect backwards, I think our previous year rents were turned out to be pretty economical and pretty profitable, and I think most of our operators, to the greatest extent, have a fair amount of money in the bank, and that's not any reason to give it away, don't get me wrong, but I think that they've been pretty comfortable with our historic leasing rates over the last 5, 10, 15 years.
I'm going to follow this just a bit. Is that to say that you're bringing income forward from the previous year for the landowner? What kind of precedent does that set? Has that always happened? Tell me more about that.
Well, that was not the intent, but I think that's the reality, as you're touching on, Todd, on the basis that that's what has, in fact, happened to a modest degree. The same token, we also have a fairly significant number of bushel leases where operators lease from us on a fixed number of bushels of corn or a fixed number of bushels of beans, primarily corn. And I'm not prepared to talk about this, Todd, but we also have an experimental lease, which is a variable lease. It's cash rent based, but it's driven by commodity prices over a period of a year. And I'll be frank, one of our operators brought the idea to us 2 years ago, and we've been experimenting with it, and we're going to have probably 15 to 20 farms under this variable lease on a go-forward basis. And I really believe, maybe not next year, but 2 years from now here at NAFB, we'll be able to sit down and talk about kind of a creative idea on how we can maybe soften some of this volatility from a cash rent point of view.
How do you view, since you're in Champaign, how do you view the University of Illinois' recommendations that farmers not sign cash rent agreements until March if they can possibly hold off?
We feel very, very strongly that the farmer needs to go into, I mean, the capital investment he's making in machinery and storage and in inputs, it goes on and on and on. And the farmer needs to have locked in well into the fall of the year, before harvest starts or during harvest at the absolute latest, a game plan that he knows where he'll stand for the coming crop year, because the capital investment is large, to say the least.
Thank you very much, Murray.
Thank you, Todd. Great to be with you.
That's Murray Wise from the Westchester Group in Champaign, Illinois. You've been listening to the Closing Market Report. I'm Todd Gleason. You have a great Thanksgiving afternoon.